Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder, everyone, we are Zooming on Sunday afternoon, and given the fact that things seem to be changing by the hour, if something happens on Sunday night, I promise you we'll talk about it on Tuesday. So before we begin our show, you know what the drill is. We begin every single show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I wanted everyone to have his voice ringing in their ears when they exercise the franchise this November. Of course, some of you have already started voting, whether you're voting by mail, whether you're voting absentee, or whether you're voting in person. The most important thing you do, if you care about your country, you care about the future, and you want to embrace something that used to be called democracy, is that you exercise the franchise. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, impeachment hearings 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So this is our Rethink the Week. It is chock-a-block full of interesting guests and some new folks to the Rethink the Week. Let me introduce sort of two regulars. Joining us, as he always does, is Professor Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com, and he is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let me welcome Dean Spiliotis to the program. How are you, Dean?
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
Professor Stefan Schmidt, I have known for over 20 years. He is affectionately known in Iowa as Dr. Politics. He is a professor of political science at Iowa State, although I think right now he's a professor emeritus because rumor has it he has finally retired, but I don't believe that. And Stefan and Arnie have been covering presidential politics since 1999 and 2000. So welcome to the program, Stefan.
Thank you very much. This is a wonderful panel, and I'll enjoy listening to what my colleagues have to say. They're much more knowledgeable than I am.
Well, I think we all bring something interesting to the table. Joining us from California is Dave Atkins. He is a writer and activist from California. He's a contributor to the Washington Monthly's Political Animal. He is an elected DNC member and president of the Pollux Group, a qualitative research firm. And again, because of his location in California, not only am I grateful that you're joining us, David, but it reminds us that we need to sort of also focus on what's happening as a result of climate change. And that includes the fires that have right now killed approximately 31 people, as I read in the paper this morning. So welcome to the program, David.
Yeah, air is smoky out here. Good to be here. Thanks.
And Adele Stan, I have known for a long time. She is a columnist at the American Prospect, and she is the editor of Right Wing Watch. Boy, have you a lot to cover. And she is the winner of the Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Welcome back to the program, Adele.
Great to be with you, Arnie.
So I decided that, you know, I sent you 1,000 articles. We will not even get to one third of them. But I'm looking at an article by my old friend, Walter Shapiro. And for those of you who don't know Walter, Walter has been covering presidential campaigns. I think he's covered the last 9 campaigns. So he's been around the block a long time. He also works with the Brennan Center. But he wrote this: Biden should be worried. Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis has scrambled the presidential race irrevocably. So I'm going to go to David, my DNC member. And so, David, after the debate, I'm not sure you can call it a debate. I call it a political abortion. But after whatever it was a train wreck. We saw Biden's numbers just spike. People were appalled at what they saw. People that even liked Donald Trump were kind of like, what are you doing, Donald? And So you saw that happen. And then we've been expecting it for a long time, David. Finally, Donald Trump got COVID. The germaphobe Donald Trump, who hasn't been wearing a mask, who's put himself in these really sort of vulnerable situations because I don't know whether he thought he was invincible or he thought that a test would protect him. But now he's in the hospital. How does the Biden campaign look at this situation and manage to thread the needle between now and just the next couple of weeks that he can survive before the sort of final result of an election that we probably won't know until the end of November? But it does change, I think, the political dynamic somewhat.
Look, I have two hats here. One is as a DNC member and one is as a political analyst. You know, with my DNC member hat, it's like, oh no, everything is fine, normal. It doesn't affect him at all. He's doing what he's going to be doing. But that's honestly the truth. Like, putting on the analyst hat here, he's not really doing anything different from what he would be doing. I mean, he obviously, the biggest concern is whether Trump, who appears to potentially be the super spreader here, and there's some question as to whether Hope Hicks got it first or whether he got it first. He might be the vector here. And if that's the case, then hopefully there was enough separation between him and Biden during the debate, and Biden will remain COVID negative. I mean, that's my biggest concern. I think that has to be one of the biggest concerns with the campaign. As far as the politics of it, as we know, Biden has stopped airing negative ads. Trump has refused to do likewise, but that's because there's a decency voter out there, right? A voter who cares about public decency. And those voters are shifting all the way over to the Democrats for the most part. And that all falls in line. Biden campaign strategy has to be the same going forward. He's winning by the public polls anywhere from 7 to 14 points right now. He's doing what he needs to do. It's far more interesting to look at what the Trump chaos people are trying to do right now.
So I'm going to go to my presidential scholar, Dean Spiliotis. So Dean, there is a concern that there'll be this sympathy for Donald Trump. So if I were the Biden campaign, I would say, obviously, I'm hoping that he and Melania recover. But would I spend all the time talking about everybody else in the executive branch that has COVID and everyone that's been around him that has COVID and Chris Christie that has COVID and now another aide that has COVID and the support staff that has COVID? Is that the way, Dean, to deal with Donald Trump and COVID? Be as sympathetic as you can be with the president, but then talk about the conga line of people around him that actually now have contracted the disease, because not only did Donald Trump basically sort of poo-poo the concept of masking and social distancing, but now he has, you know, become the spreader within his own camp.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard a number of Democratic strategists on television over the weekend saying and kind of reminding voters that you can feel sympathy towards the president and his family for the illness, but also not forget that he's in large part in the predicament he's in because of his own cavalier attitude and neglect on COVID. You know, the Democrats all along had wanted to keep COVID front and center in the election. And, you know, they were concerned that the Supreme Court was going to take the focus off of COVID, that even, you know, the taxes and law and order and all the other things that Trump has put out there, that all of that might in some way take fundamental focus over the administration's failure to deal with the pandemic. So they got their wish now. It's going to basically stay on COVID for pretty much most of the rest of the way. You know, we may have this, if Mitch McConnell can at all help it, even with three Republican senators now infected, we may still get that vote right before the election on Judge Barrett. They have a wide open lane now to talk about COVID and the failure of the administration pretty much nonstop. So it's potentially this will put President Trump in a more sympathetic light. I've already heard a lot of skepticism that should he recover, that he will come out in any way a changed man, that he may very well fall very quickly into his previous behavior. But there are just a lot of unknowns right now, and we really don't know. But the minimum thing is that the Democrats said they wanted to keep this focused on COVID. You can't have any more focused means of talking about COVID than have a president and administration that have downplayed this repeatedly, had mocked people, including Joe Biden as recently as the debate.
Yes,
earlier this
exactly.
week about wearing a mask. This is just kind of all caught up in this sort of Trumpian concerns about masculinity and manliness, and masks are not manly. They make you look weak. All that kind of stuff is still there. So that's what they wanted to talk about. Now they have a clear lane to talk about it.
Adele, you do Right Wing Watch. And I know that in Right Wing Watch, they've been poo-pooing the science. They don't believe the scientists. They don't believe the doctors. They don't believe anything. Now, I have only doctors to believe when I have to listen to Donald Trump. Do I like now go to Right Wing Watch and say, but you don't believe the doctors. You don't believe the scientists. You don't believe this stuff. I mean, I feel like Donald Trump is now between a rock and a hard place. Now we have to, you know, believe these people that are rolling out, that are telling us, oh, he's fine. Oh, his, you know, his oxygen levels are fine. And yet we've been told that, you know, you don't really trust the doctors. You can only trust Donald Trump. But now he's rolling out doctors that we have to embrace. And the doctors seem to be a bit confusing anyway.
Well, Arnie, I mean, the thing is that among Trump's base, MAGA world, QAnon, all of that, I mean, you have to understand that cognitive dissonance is the coin of the realm. So what we're seeing, especially from QAnon crowd, but others, that a whole rack of conspiracy theories about Trump's contracting of COVID. There's a lot of people saying on the far right or on the hard right that the Dems gave it to him. Right? It's like the Navalny poisoning or something, you know, that somehow the Dems gave it to him, the Democrats. You're also seeing on QAnon that it's some great secret plan because QAnon is all about presenting Trump as this super hero type.
He has good genes. Trust me.
Yes. The genetics piece of it is really fascinating too. I mean, Brendan Dilley who's a big MAGA world life coach. If you want to live your life in MAGA world, Dilley's a great example. I mean, he's making a living off of it. Yeah. So, you know, they're saying, oh, yes, but Trump has super genes. He has super genes and he's going to beat this. And I got to say, I was just kind of floored by his doctor saying, oh, well, he'll probably be out of the hospital by Monday.
On Monday. So that actually, I want to toss to Stefan. Stefan, the doctor said he might be out by Monday, but you know what they're going to provide for us? They're going to provide for us a picture of his lungs. Now, I hate to say this, Stefan. When was the picture taken? This is how insane it has become, Stefan, that when a doctor says, trust me, we're going to maybe release him on Monday, but we're going to show you an x-ray of his lungs. And I'm trying to figure out if a doctor can tell me when an x-ray was taken, because I am completely convinced that nothing is real, because Donald Trump has proven to me that nothing is real. But that I have to even think that, to me, is so terrifying, Stefan.
There was a tiny lung picture taken right next to the bone spur. And so we know when it was taken, you know, there's no mystery there. Let me be a little contrarian, because yes, absolutely, we're hyperventilating about, you know, what a disaster this is and how everybody's been contaminated and oh my God and oh my God. Well, a lot of people have been contaminated before now in the White House, people very close to Donald Trump, and they didn't die. You know, they didn't even go to the hospital. So all the people that have been contaminated, if they all come out okay, Chris Christie, you know, comes back again and is fine, and Donald Trump is in fact released at some point, then the narrative is that it is just like a small flu. Wow. Yes, old people, sick people, people working in meatpacking plants are very vulnerable and they'll die. But, you know, we didn't die. And so there's a possibility that also will enter into the discussion. Whether it will be effective or not, Arnie, I don't know.
So, David, does this then give Joe Biden an opportunity to talk about healthcare? Because I think what Stefan is saying and the kind of care that we're seeing the president getting and all this opportunity, what we know is that how many people are uninsured, underinsured, are not even getting into the hospital, but are dying at home. Is this a way to sort of say that, again, it's two systems, the system for the wealthy and the elite, and then the system for the rest of us. And this is now about the fact that the American people are expendable, but not my people, as in Donald Trump.
Of course. And there are so many intersecting angles on the healthcare front, right? Not only the underlying difference between the two parties, obviously on expanding access to healthcare and reducing cost, but also on the about the Supreme Court, where they're putting forward that literally they very likely got themselves all sick and infected with COVID, having a party to dance on RBG's grave in order to install a Supreme Court justice who would eliminate healthcare protections for Americans, right? And they got themselves sick while doing it. The challenge, I mean, with Trump going out and saying, let's assume that he survives this, right? He survives, he comes out, he says, I'm an Ubermensch, I have the greatest genes. And if everyone else just, you know, this virus isn't anything to be afraid of, and all you peons should go out to casinos without masks. The problem with that is not only is that insulting to the 215,000 who have already died and all the people with lingering problems who are recovering from COVID still, and it's an insult to them. The problem is, as you say, he has been getting the best of care. He's been getting cocktails of experimental drugs, stuff that he's really ethically not supposed to get. They're putting him on compassionate use, which is... No, I mean, I agree that the president of the United States should be getting everything that should be possible, but it's not what normal people are getting. And in fact, not only is it not what normal people are getting, normal people are being told not to seek hospitalization until they're literally coughing their lungs out. So Trump, Chris Christie, all these people, they're going in and getting hospitalized with drugs the rest of us can't get, early hospitalization the rest of us can't get. So even if he comes out and says, look, I beat this, y'all can beat it too. First of all, 215,000 dead people couldn't. And secondly, no, you can't, because he's getting a level of treatment that other people don't have access to, which is really parallels the whole conversation about healthcare in the United States.
So Adele, one of the things we've learned is that some of the best super spreaders in the world are children. They may not die, but right. They are like wicked, wicked super spreaders. Mm-hmm. So the reason I bring this up is I want to go back to the Amy Coney Barrett event at the White House. And there's a picture of Melania and all of Amy Coney Barrett's kids right next to each other, like sardines. And I am looking at this going, what kind of a mother is Amy Coney Barrett? If she puts her kids into a vulnerable setting where we see nobody wearing masks, where her children are there, where they could be super spreaders or they could get it, which means that they're not only bringing it home, but they're bringing it to like probably hundreds of other children as a result and their parents. And I think in a bizarre way, this is going to be the toughest series of hearings with Lindsey Graham's committee, not because of what Lindsey Graham is going to say, but Amy Coney Barrett now... Questions are being raised on every level about the kind of justice and the kind of prudence and the kind of exercise that she has shown just because of what happened at that event, let alone all the other reasons why we're hysterical about her possible nomination and appointment to the bench.
Well, the other thing that we learned about Amy Coney Barrett is that she had COVID, and the only specificity she's given is that she had it this summer and is fully recovered. Now, it's been pointed out that she's an attorney, and summer didn't end until September 21st or September 22nd. I think that is really something that she needs to answer to. Did she go into that room having just had recovered from COVID, 2 weeks prior? It's hard to know, in terms of her, mothering skills or application of those skills. I'm not ready to go down that road. I do think that even very smart people can choose to believe, unwittingly choose to believe what they want to believe because it fits their worldview. It's sort of human nature. However, I do think there is a lot for her to answer to in terms of when did she quote unquote recover from COVID? When was her last negative test? All of that. So, and the fact that, her prior utterances indicate that she wants to overturn the Affordable Care Act.
Which is pre-existing conditions.
And a host of other things. I mean, just in terms of not being able to get kicked off your healthcare for one reason or another. There's a lot to unpack there.
So Dean, as I'm thinking about all this, I'm thinking about the fact that she has to go before Lindsey Graham's committee, and Jamie Harrison and Lindsey Graham just debated. And they said it was, they said in a lot of ways, it was actually a very good debate. I mean, it was on, it, unlike the presidential debate, if we could do a split screen, one was insane and the other one was sort of like the normal expectation of what we're going to see in a debate. But Lindsey Graham, over and over again during that debate, talked about Amy Coney Barrett. That's what he talked about, that we need her on the bench. This is what he is. He was sort of like, I'm thinking about South Carolina voters who are unemployed, who are sick, who are worried about their health care, who are worried about their incomes, who are worried about their kids' school. And only thing that Lindsey Graham could really, really talk about was the court. And I know that the base is concerned about the court, but do you think Lindsey Graham has sort of now become so out of touch with how people live their lives that this debate, not only did it not serve him well, but he really could be in trouble because during the course of this debate, his focus was on something that I hate to break it to you. When I wake up in the morning, I don't think about Amy. When I go to bed, I don't think about Amy, but I know what I do think about from morning till night. And that is, can my kid go to school? Will my kid get COVID? What about my job? What about my healthcare? And he just seems so out of touch.
Yeah, you know, I think at some level, he probably feels like, well, that's the one thing that Republicans still have going for them that appeals to conservatives, the huge number of federal judges that President Trump will have appointed to the bench in his first term. I mean, potentially three Supreme Court justices is nothing to scoff at. And, you know, I think part of the problem is in an age of legislative gridlock, each party increasingly points to their ability to appoint judges as some means of kind of getting around that gridlock. So, he mentioned, I watched some of the debate, and I think that the moderator gets a lot of credit.
Yes.
The format was better. Obviously, the personalities are different. And, you know, the challenger noted that Graham didn't have a lot of legislative accomplishments to show for decades in office. The race is in the margin of error. I think Trump is leading Biden reasonably in South Carolina. It would be shocking. I mean, that would be a real indicator of an upset if Lindsey Graham were to lose that race.
Yeah.
That would probably signal much larger problems for Republicans nationwide. But, you know, I think things have been so chaotic. There's been so little legislative productivity in recent years. So many Republicans, evangelicals are unhappy with Trump and the tenor of the administration that this, the kind of incantation of judges, the one thing a lot of these senators seem to have left. And, you know, my sense is that barring some numbers issue and where, you know, those other senators are not able to get back to vote and they don't have a quorum, you know, and this gets kicked over until after the election. If that were to happen, and if Biden were to win a convincing victory, then maybe, although I'm not particularly optimistic, you know, maybe you'll have Collins and Murkowski. Pat Toomey the rumor is now he's not going to run for re-election in Pennsylvania. He's a Republican. He could have a moment of conscience, Mitt Romney. So in theory, you could get those four, but it's a long way to get there. My guess is if at all possible,
so
this is going to get rammed through. It doesn't really matter what Coney Barrett has said or done. This is a numbers game. It's a quorum game. And it's Mitch McConnell working the system.
But Stefan, I understand what Dean is saying, but right now this is about Lindsey Graham's life. He has no life but politics. It is his lover, his mother, his father, his relationship. That has been the only thing that has defined him for virtually his entire life. So he is not only wanting to get reelected, but I'm not sure he can imagine life without it. Given that, and the fact that the numbers are so close in South Carolina, and I really do think that while the judge thing may be important to the base, because of COVID, because of the economy, because of jobs, because of so many other things, that in South Carolina, eating is more important than a judge. Okay, I'm just going to say that. Does this mean that he could go to Mitch McConnell and make a suggestion, work with Mnuchin, get something that we can deliver checks to South Carolina? If there are vulnerable Republicans, what they need is another COVID deal where they can bring back stuff to stabilize the hemorrhaging economy and the people that are on food lines.
Yes, interesting proposition. My greatest concern actually is that regardless of what the polls show and how well they do in their debates and so on, is there going to be a lot of voter suppression? Are a lot of voters who would love to vote against Lindsey Graham actually going to be able to find a polling place? Are they going to suddenly disappear from the rolls of certified voters? I mean, that's an enormous problem. You know, public opinion is one thing, but the actual reality on the ground of people being able to exercise the right to vote, to get to polling places, that is, in the final analysis, the biggest issue. Of course, people are voting now. People, you know, are starting to vote by mail. And so the question is, you know, is it easy to vote by mail or is it difficult in South Carolina? I lived in South Carolina for four summers, many months each summer. And it's an interesting place, but not necessarily a very fair place in some ways.
So as I'm going to sort of close off this segment, but as I'm thinking about the South Carolina voter, there's a term of art that really sort of describes the American voter. And I think this is really important, especially given the economy, the pandemic, and everything else that is now causing us to hemorrhage in ways we've never imagined before. And that Americans think of themselves as philosophically conservative, but operationally liberal. Operationally liberal. And the reason I say that is one of the things supposedly Lindsey Graham suggested was that senior citizens should just offer to take less in Social Security checks. Now, if he actually said that, I've been checking to make sure I saw that on my Facebook page, and I just can't believe it, but it's possible he said it. But if he actually said that, ooh, that is totally, totally out of touch, because people are operationally liberal. And that is a check that is so essential. On that, we're going to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of Rethink the Week. This is The Attitude with Donnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
I'm the innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between the rock and the hard place. And I'm down on my luck. I'm hiding in Honduras. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns and money. It has hit the fan. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is a continuation of our Rethink the Week. We have Adele Stan, a columnist for The American Prospect and the editor of Right Wing Watch. We have Professor Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Professor Stefan Schmidt, a.k.a. Dr. Politics, a professor of political science at Iowa State. And David Atkins, a writer and activist from California and a contributor to The Washington Monthly's Political Animal. Hi, David. I want to talk about voting. I want to talk about absentee voting. I want to talk about the fact that the governor of Texas has decided to only allow one drop box per county in Texas. I mean, what a schmuck. But before we do this, California is close to Texas. And I want to talk a little bit about how California is addressing voting, given what's happened because of the fires. Because we're talking about something that has impacted the quality of life. It has seen people trying to relocate because of the fires. We're looking at millions of acres that have disappeared. We're looking at 31 people who have died. We're looking at an inability sometimes to breathe. So if you're worried about COVID and you're wearing a mask, then the question becomes, are you wearing the mask because of pollution? Or are you wearing the mask because you're fearing the spread? So give us a snapshot of how they're approaching both this election and the fact that they're trying to figure out how to contain these fires. I know two of them have been contained, but contained for one day is not contained for the future.
Yeah, look, I mean, from the fire side, it is what it is, right? The first focus is on saving lives and on getting people to the access that they need, to the care that they need, right? From the voting side, California has the most progressive voting laws, I think, in the entire country. You could argue that states that already have long since done vote by mail across the entire state, like Oregon, maybe more so. But within the context of maybe a more traditional voting state, obviously everybody's getting ballots by mail. All you have to do is postmark the ballot by election day and it counts, which means that votes even that come into the elections office 5 days later, they will still count. As long as the postmarks aren't being messed with, nothing that the Postal Service or that Louis DeJoy does will matter, because as long as they get there and as long as they're postmarked on time, it will count. There are counties with dozens, literally dozens of ballot drop-off boxes stationed all across their counties. So California has the most liberal voting laws in that sense and the most expansive voting laws. So, and I think California can provide an objective lesson for what the rest of the country can do if you push Republicans out of government. And when Republicans are no longer able to blockade what you're allowed to do, then suddenly all sorts of new options open up for, you know, expanding access, expanding civil rights, expanding access to the vote, that then makes it very difficult for conservatives to regain a foothold because the people can actually speak their voice. And if we can do that at a federal level through HR 1, adding states, a variety of options that we have at the federal level, then we can make the national system look more like the California system. And that will help democracy itself.
So I mentioned that the governor of Texas has decided to shut down all the ballot drop-off sites except for one per county. And I think that part of what I know about Governor Abbott is that Governor Abbott is between a rock and a hard place. He had like high approval ratings at the beginning of the year. His response to COVID sucked. He saw his approval ratings just completely crater out. He then decided that he had to do something, recognizing that there was concern about this pandemic in Texas. So he expanded early voting by a week. Then his own chairman of the Republican Party in Texas decided to sue the Republican governor for expanding early voting by a week. So now his answer to the Republican GOP chairman is, okay, well, then at least I'll shut down all the drop boxes except for one per county. I mean, this is like a whack-a-mole. It's like, you know, you try to do something, then you sort of take it back. Then you try to do something, then you take it back. I mean, Texas is insanity when it comes to this, because not only are we trying to figure out how to address the vote because of Donald Trump, but now you've got the Republican Party eating their young in Texas. I mean, David said, get rid of them. I'm looking at Republicans and they're getting rid of each other.
Yeah, you know, I read that one of these counties with a one drop box is like the size of Rhode Island, which is quite remarkable. You'd have to drive hours to put your ballot in a drop box. And Abbott is saying this is a function of the need for security. But, you know, as we're seeing, I think the state Democratic Party has now filed a lawsuit claiming voter suppression. This is just the reality of electoral politics right now. We know that the rules are really set by the states, which to some extent goes against President Trump's idea that he can in some way tip the scales nationally. All of this stuff is being fought out in state courts. There's something now, like at least probably more now that Texas, there's this one in Texas, is over 30 lawsuits, I think, that are pending on various aspects of ballot access. And so, you know, the concern is that rather than having a single Florida like we did in 2000, we could end up with a dozen Floridas with this being litigated like crazy after Election Day. And I think, you know, I think in some level, that's Trump's strategy. And then hoping that it'll get kicked up to the Supreme Court at some point. He almost talks about the Supreme Court as it's kind of part of the electoral process. That's like the natural end of the election is that the Supreme Court will decide who gets to be president.
Actually, I think he talks about the Supreme Court like it's part of his family. There's Ivanka, there's so-and-so, oh yeah, and then there's the Supreme Court. Like he assumes that whatever happens, they will support his re-election. He makes an assumption. But Adele, you sent us an interesting article about what's happening with voting. And I just want to read something from this article, Adele. At least three other, you were talking about all these lavishly funded far-right groups like Judicial Watch, the Public Interest Legal Foundation, and True the Vote, are combining legal challenges and propaganda efforts designed to discredit and disable remote voting for November. Okay, I agree with this. The Republican National Committee issued a statement this spring promising to devote at least $20 million to such lawsuits. Dean was just talking about those. The messages they're all promoting are identical to Trump's rhetoric about the dangers of mail-in balloting and the Democrats' purportedly cynical promotion of it to allegedly rig the election. But this is the part of the article that made me totally crazy. This guy named Mark Elias, who's a top Democratic litigator, said, "You used to have these small-time right-wing operations," he said, "who would just sort of bring out these sort of ongoing lawsuits. But because of Donald Trump, they have now normalized all these crackpot theories about voter fraud, and they've now joined forces under the banner of the legitimate Republican establishment." Oh, my God. Everyone knew they were crazy. Now crazy is the GOP, because not only are they embracing it, but they're cutting huge million-dollar checks to support the lawsuits. So what Dean was talking about is, you know, Bush v. Gore, it's going to be, you know, thousands of Bush v. Gore. And how do you end an election until you end these kinds of lawsuits?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, because there's a constitutional right, right,
to sue.
But if you look at, say, an operation like Judicial Watch, and, you know, you got to remember, like, they don't have to disclose their donors because of the laws governing nonprofits.
Right.
I mean, their contributions, their yearly budget has just, you know, ballooned since, say, 2011. I mean, I think they're now taking over more than 50 million a year, and we don't know where it's coming from.
And let's be honest. So as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, Stefan, if I were to cut a check, I think I would cut a check to Judicial Watch before I cut a check to a Republican, because I would be actually being more effective cutting the check to Judicial Watch. Because if I want to challenge the vote, if I want to challenge the results, it's not going to be because people are voting. It's because I know, and voting for A or B, it's that I can just do whatever I want, because the damage is done by raising questions about the result, about the result. And you know who taught me this, Stefan? Who taught me this was...
Lewandowski.
Thank you very much. So Corey Lewandowski told me, Arnie, nobody wants to give money to the Republican Party. They want to give money to Americans for Prosperity, because we can be more lethal than the Republican Party. And we can do it undercover, so nobody will know about where the money is coming from and where we're being directed to use it. So I really think that this is so fascinating, because we are looking at the Republicans instead of looking at these crackpot groups that are being funded by Republicans, Stefan.
Well, the Democrats, do they have groups that are receiving large amounts of money that don't have to report it, that are nonprofits, that are, you know, covered by the Supreme Court ruling, you know, that corporations and organizations also have a right to privacy and a right to free speech? I mean, I think the Democrats are funneling a tremendous amount of money into this process as well. And so it's a war between essentially not so much the parties, but these groups that don't have to report the source of their funding, you know? So it's a fascinating thing. I'm a political scientist, okay? I'm not an activist. I'm not a columnist or anything like that. And I find it interesting that the American political system is so flexible, so squishy, that you can do all kinds of things. And the Supreme Court has, of course, made it easier to do that. And so money, 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 huge amounts of it is poured, not to the party so much. And in a lot of these elections, the candidates don't even run with their party identification on the yard signs or other things. They, you know, they just run ads that attack their opponent or say how wonderful they are. And so it's an interesting moment. I think the American political system is in great peril. If there are all those lawsuits, you know, that Dean was talking about and that you were talking about, we're going to be paralyzed. I mean, we really are going to be paralyzed. There may not be any, you know, end to this election. Even when the president's term is over, will we have a president? I hope it doesn't go back to the Supreme Court again.
So David, there are a couple of things I keep thinking about. And in California, you talk about the fact you've moved Republicans out. You are able to vote by mail. It's a very sort of a useful system. So you've kind of, in some ways, taught civics in California. Mm. We haven't taught civics in most states in the United States. Not only have we not taught civics, but this whole concept of absentee balloting is kind of a new idea. All right, vote by mail, it's a new idea. You know, you have to sign here, you have to sign there, you have to put it in this envelope, you have to put it in that envelope, you have to seal it, you have to get it. I was told that in the little tiny city of Manchester, it's our biggest city, but it's like the size of a village, okay? It's not very big, that 200 ballots were basically not approved because they made mistakes when they were doing the absentee balloting. Now, 200 ballots doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're talking about in a primary and you're talking about maybe running for city councilor or whatever, 200 ballots is a lot, okay? So part of my problem with the fact that the Democratic Party especially has been encouraging people to protect themselves for COVID and not stand online and get your ballot in early and start voting is that we don't even know how to fill out the damn form. No one's ever taught us how to do it. And those forms are kind of like, they've got little landmines in them to make a mistake. And I'm not talking about the signature. I'm talking about all the other pieces. And that's the other thing I fear isn't just what's going to happen on election day with the intimidation and the poll watchers, is that good people are going to want to do the right thing, but they've never been taught the right thing, David. They don't know how to do it. They've never developed that kind of voting muscle because they've always voted in person.
Look, it's always a challenge. You're right. It's absolutely much likelier that a person who has never voted by mail before might make an error on the mail ballot. And some states make it much harder than others. Some states require a witness requirement, which you can then like fix later or maybe not. Obviously, the Pennsylvania, the naked ballot where you have to put it in the secrecy envelope before you put it in the real envelope, which is also ridiculous because that's a holdover from in-person voting. But look, the reality is that as much as a first-time vote-by-mail voter is likelier to make these kinds of errors, a person who votes by mail or commits to vote by mail is 3 to 4 times likelier to cast their ballot than someone who just plans on making it to election day, to the polls on election day.
Very good.
So we know that that is true. And on balance, the numbers are likelier to be better, particularly in a pandemic. Right. So the big, you've had the Republican Party, the institutional Republican Party, quietly at war with the president of the United States over this very issue. Because, for instance, in Florida, usually the Republicans turn out their vote by mail vote at higher rates than Democrats. And then Democrats count on catching up to them on election day, which sometimes happens, sometimes does not. But right now, Democrats are far outpacing Republicans in terms of vote-by-mail returns in Florida and in other key states. Republicans are counting on their voters all making it out on a cold November day to the polls on election day in the middle of a pandemic.
Yes.
And as a Democratic operative, I could say, well, my voters are potentially, they might make mistakes on a vote-by-mail form, and that could be a problem. But I cannot, in good conscience and good faith, ask them to go out on election day, stand in line with a bunch of Republicans who may not be wearing masks. I think potentially hundreds or thousands of people are going to get sick on election day just because they went to vote by in person. Look, it could all sort itself out. It could just be shifting some voters earlier than later. But if I were the Republicans, and I think many of them are, I would be genuinely panicked about the idea that I'm leaving all my voters to election day, whether they might turn out or not on that November in a pandemic.
And so, Republicans have known forever exactly what you said, and the president has no freaking clue. You know, I mean, again, because all he cares about is somehow, he wants to bring chaos into the system. He also wants to bring, remember, what did he tell you? He wants all these poll watchers, armed poll watchers, I suspect. I mean, they're not just going to be there. I mean, Adele, I can remember being a young legislator and voting on a gun bill in the New Hampshire legislature. And we had to walk through a phalanx of Second Amendment boys, and literally it was all men, all wearing their like, you know, orange and their fatigues. And I mean, it was like running a gauntlet, and their whole purpose was intimidation. Their whole purpose was intimidation. And then they lined the balcony and they looked down at us. I was waiting for them to spit on us because of this. And I remember at one point, I was actually more sympathetic to them on a piece of legislation, but I was so shocked at the level of intimidation and threat that they basically wanted to exert. And I'm an elected official. I'm not just a voter. You know, who's just going in, going, I'm out of here. I'm just leaving. So I took my middle finger, Adele. Yeah. And I put my middle finger up in the air, up in the balcony. And I said, see this? And I voted green on the bill because I was just, the more they intimidated, the angrier I got. Now, I am a crazy lady and I am unique.
No.
But I am worried about what, you know, Donald Trump is doing, which is really inviting people who, as David said, are not going to be wearing masks. In my state, they will be armed, not inside the polling place, but outside the polling place. And they will be sort of looking at going, I don't recognize you. Are you sure you live in this, you know, community? Especially if it's someone under the age of 22 in a college town. The level of intimidation is another reason why I think we really want people to vote by mail, because the one good thing about voting in person is how do they know it's a Republican or a Democrat that they're intimidating?
No, well, right. Well, I think, you know, a few things about that. I mean, I think it's very interesting that Trump has been focused on Philadelphia and saying, you know, that Philadelphia is a really bad things happen in Philadelphia, because they're trying to encourage people to do this in Philadelphia, because if they can suppress vote in Philly, they've got a shot at winning Pennsylvania. And there's really not a path for among Trump's advisors don't see a path for him without Pennsylvania, without winning Pennsylvania.
Good point.
Yeah. So I mean, you have a lot of that. And plus, there was years ago, you know, an incident with a tiny group called the New Black Panthers. So they're able to do some racial scaremongering around that. So you got that going on. But I want to also just note something that David was talking about, where you have Trump at war with the Republican Party over the vote by mail thing. As Bob Moser notes in the piece that he wrote for Right Wing Watch on the war against vote by mail, while Judicial Watch is running lawsuits to get states and counties to purge their voter rolls, you have Americans for Prosperity organizing people to vote by mail at the same time. So, you know, they've got all sides of it covered. Yeah. But the intimidation thing is real. And I mean, given what we've seen at the protests this year, with a lot of right wing actors wanting to sow chaos, I think it is worrying.
It is. And Dean, a lot of people that I know, especially in more rural areas or small states like New Hampshire, where you have volunteers that are at the polls, that are, you know, helping people and assisting them in voting. And, you know, you've got, again, it's going to be interesting to see about how the mask issue is going to go going forward as a result of the president contracting COVID. So if I had said, you know, that he didn't get COVID, I would be terrified about what would happen because of the whole mask issue and exercising the franchise and all the volunteers that are in there going, I don't want to volunteer. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be intimidated. And yet I think, again, as, you know, Walter Shapiro said, you know, the fact that he contracted COVID, it is going to be very interesting to see whether we're going to have a Charles Dickens novel and he's going to be a sort of a born again politician as a result of COVID, or whether the whole mask issue, which in a lot of ways has been very useful for people that want to do voter intimidation, because if you walk in with a mask, you must be voting Democratic. If you walk in without a mask, we know who you are and we're not going to intimidate you. Now the question will be, what if Donald Trump suddenly starts, you know, embracing the idea of masking because of this whole pandemic thing, basically biting him in the proverbial butt?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've heard people suggest that, you know, maybe he'll be a changed man coming out of the hospital, assuming that he gets through this. But my sense is I don't expect any kind of sudden, complete and utter conversion. My concern is, you know, New Hampshire may not, is fairly rural. The primaries went fairly smoothly. It is an issue. You know, a lot of our poll workers are retirees. I know they've been looking for younger poll workers to step in their place. His call for people to go to the polling places to watch is very concerning. I mean, both parties are entitled to poll watchers, but you don't want people, particularly people who are armed and openly carrying, showing up to try to intimidate voters. So, you know, this is all a bit of a wild card. And some have suggested that Trump's hope is that, you know, Trump knows that Democrats are voting by mail at much higher rates than Republicans, and likely to be the case. In some of these close states, out in the Midwest in particular, maybe even Pennsylvania, you know, that on election night, he'll be leading narrowly. because a lot of the Democratic ballots haven't been counted yet. And he's essentially going to try to freeze the race in place, declare victory, and then litigate the hell out of everything that comes after Election Day. So that's certainly one possible scenario. But there's just, you know, because this is a decentralized system, I think we're going to see some places it's going to go smoothly. I think in some places we're going to have real problems.
All right. So we haven't talked about the fact, Stefan, that there is a debate coming up this week. And the debate isn't going to be a debate where I have to start talking about what are the new rules for the debate, because it's going to be a debate between Kamala Harris and Vice President Pence. So what are we expecting from this? And if you were, take off your, you know, governor, you know, your political science hat, if you were giving guidance to Kamala, what would you sort of tell her to sort of stress? And if you were giving guidance to Pence, where do you think he should go? What's the Kamala vulnerabilities and what's the Pence vulnerabilities?
Well, I think Pence has to be careful and not beat up on a woman. That has been a real problem, and I think that's a real possibility. Pence needs to stay calm and talk about, you know, some of the things that this administration has accomplished, and there are a bunch of things that have been done that we don't talk about much, and I think he can talk about that. She probably should be very careful and not reach into her dress or her pants and pull out the stiletto, because she can be really a hard fighter. She is a tough, tough debater with a lot of experience. And, you know, she has to come across as being more essentially policy oriented than I think she might do.
David, oh God, as a former girl politician, okay, I'm a politician in recovery. I am so sick of being told to be sweet and nice and not take out my stiletto as these guys take out chainsaws, okay? And in some ways, I'm almost wondering whether Kamala can say, is this a time for me to be kind and gentle? Or do you want to hear me as a fighter for you? You know, in a way, almost talk about it, so that when she pulls out that stiletto that Stefan was saying, or when she gets sharp, she reminds them, I have to be sharp, because this is about your life. This is about your health. This is about your job. This is about your kid. And we have been too looking the other way with Donald Trump. And now look at what's happened. The billionaires are wildly successful and you're on food lines. This is unacceptable in America. And I am not going to be sweet and nice.
Yeah, look, this is a real challenge, because the contours of misogyny are really interesting when they reflect themselves in political debates. For instance, people expected that Trump would be much nicer to Biden because of misogyny than Clinton. But there is a sense in which, when you're a man debating a woman, for instance, there's a sense in which there's an expectation that you'll go a little softer, whereas Trump was trying to dominate Biden man to man during the debate. So you get this weird push and pull with the misogyny of these things. With regard to how a woman treats a man, Pence is going to be an interesting opponent, because Pence has this capacity of remaining very, very calm while absolutely lying about everything. Most liars are more Trumpish in the sense that they're sort of grandiose with their lies. You rarely get someone who just stiffly, woodenly, completely calmly is just willing to lie directly to your face all the time, but to seem very calm and gentle about it. Without regard to the gender politics of it, if Kamala comes out swinging really, really hard and aggressively against Pence, he could come out being the sympathetic character just on general principle, without regardless to gender dynamics. You add in the gender dynamics and it becomes even more dangerous for Harris. But I do think that Harris does have a personality that she has honed and crafted as one of these characters that we've seen as archetypes, who can be a forceful woman on stage and not trigger a bunch of those misogynistic trips that a lot of people have. So I think she can come up more aggressively. Yeah.
So Adele, before we let all of you go, there may be another presidential debate. There may be. And everyone's talking about changing the rules, all right? They're going to like maybe shut off the mic. Maybe they're going to hermetically seal each one of them until it's their time to talk. Who the hell knows what they're going to do? By definition, Donald Trump doesn't play by rules. Donald Trump doesn't tell the truth. He doesn't play by rules. So rules sound nice, But I'm not sure rules have meaning when it comes to a debate performance. And that's why, as I'm looking at everyone talking about how we need to change the rules, I just kind of look at them and going, what's the point? What's the point? And people look at me horrified, and I'm going, when has he ever, ever played by the rules? And I go back to the very beginning when he was just announcing he was running for president. Remember when it used to be you had to physically show up at CNN? You had to physically show up at MSNBC? He freaking phoned it in. And he's been breaking the rules ever since. So why should we think that somehow rules matter?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on what you can get them to agree to. Now, somebody mentioned if you did it by Zoom, if you had a Zoom debate, the host can mute. You know, the host can mute very easily. You know, you write that into the rules. Now, whether the Trump campaign would ever, you know, agree to such a thing is a whole nother matter. I don't foresee another presidential debate, having had this disease myself and having had symptoms from what we can glean that were very similar to what Trump is going through now. But, you know, everybody's different. People have different underlying conditions. People have different, you know, weaknesses, and we don't understand the disease. But I have a really hard time seeing how that could be a good move for Trump at this point.
So I have to let you all go, but I think that COVID, from Donald Trump's perspective, is kind of a blessing because he saw his numbers tank after the last debate. He does not know how to perform in any other way than what you saw with that. And he doesn't want to risk tanking because right now he's got COVID and the gods and the miracle drugs and all that stuff. Why trash it with a debate? Let's be honest. With that, this is our Rethink the Week with Artie Artisan on The Attitude, producer Ken Barnes. I want to thank Adele Stan, a columnist for The American Prospect and editor of Right Wing Watch. Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Stefan Schmidt, Dr. Politics from Iowa State. And David Atkins, take care of yourself. Make sure that we fight those fires in California. And again, he also writes for a Washington Monthly's Political Animal. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude. Ciao, everyone. Stay safe and wear a mask. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Some say Paul, my God, well, you know there ain't but one God made us all, God's gonna trouble the water, everybody gonna just wait on me, wait on the water. God's gonna trouble the water. Way, I'm your God.